Hey guys, want to thank you for joining us for this 148th episode in Season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. Special guests on this episode include podcaster and former Navy SEAL Jocko Willink. We'll talk about his new book, Final Spin. We'll also visit with actor Bruce Campbell. He has a new movie, Black Friday, which will be available in theaters and on demand November 19th. And we'll visit with actress, now author, Karen Grassley, as her first memoir, Bright Lights, Prairie Dust, Reflections on Life, Loss, and Love from Little House's Ma, available next Tuesday, November 16th. Of course, if you would, please take the time to subscribe, comment, leave some feedback, check out the shop, and share with your friends. Now, the saddest part about this stat is that it even includes going downstairs. 40% of Americans say that going up or down a single flight of stairs makes them realize how out of shape they are. 3 in 5 people admit they're reluctant to exercise. Half of those people said it's because exercise just feels like a lot. And since we don't move around much, we deal with lots of aches and pains when we do occasionally get moving. Our sorest body part on any given day is our feet or legs. Now, the rest of the top 5 are a sore back, sore shoulders, sore neck, and sore arms or hands. And 11% of Americans say their butt is one of their sorest body parts. Retired U.S. Navy SEAL, also a co-author of the New York Times bestseller Extreme Ownership, we've got Jocko Willink with us today. And Jocko, always great to visit with you, my friend.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Cameron.
Got a new book to talk about, Final Spin, and kind of changing things up a little bit with this, Jocko.
Yeah, this is a novel. So this is a work of fiction, and it's based on a bunch of crazy characters that I've known throughout my life and a bunch of different people. And I kind of threw them into a pretty crazy environment. There's an older brother who has a mental challenge, a little mental disability, and he's obsessed with laundromats and cleaning clothes and laundry detergent. And he actually works in a laundromat. And then he's got a younger brother who's about 23 years old, who's a charismatic guy, handsome, smart, funny, but who's made some bad choices in his life. And he actually works as a stock boy in a big box store. And as the story proceeds, it looks like the laundromat where the older brother works is going to be sold. And the younger brother worries that if that happens, the older brother is never going to be able to be happy. So the younger brother decides he's going to buy the laundromat. The only way he can figure out to get the money to do that is by stealing it from the store where he works. So him and his buddy come up with a plan. They go to execute the plan. Of course, we know that things don't always go as planned.
That is true. And Jocko, you could speak to that as well. And how much the determination on your part to write a novel? I mean, what was that process like after all of your other many ventures that you've had? What brought this one on for you?
You know, I've got so many different stories in my head, Cameron. Sometimes it seems a little bit crazy. And this is just the one that bubbled to the top. This is the one that had the strongest, sounded the strongest in my head. The one that I kept thinking about. I kept thinking about this story and this plot line and these people and how it would turn out for them. And the lessons that I could, you know, get across in this book about how to treat other people and the pathway to happiness and the meaning of sacrifice and really trying to help people understand more about human nature. And as all those things came together. For me, writing is just manual labor. I know what the words are. They're in my head, and I just have to get in front of a computer and write them down.
Now, Jocko, what is your cure for writer's block, or did you ever have that issue?
I've actually never had it. I think I'm about 10 books deep, and I've never had writer's block. So let's hope it keeps going that way.
Now, where do you get the inspiration as you're sitting down and writing? Does the story constantly evolve while you're actually putting pen to paper or typing away? Or do you already have it already in the head and it's just the process of getting it out onto the paper?
It's just the process of getting it out in my paper. I have the whole thing in my head, and I've got so many of these books in my head. I'll never be able to write them all.
That's cool. Now, Jocko, this last couple of years, has that helped your writing, your inspiration, or has it maybe with the heaviness of everything around, has that made it a little harder for you to find inspiration?
No, to me, the everything that we've gone through as a country in the last couple of years, this is all just life for me. There's always ups and downs in life. And I think that's what you need to learn, to roll with the punches and push through things, even when they get challenging. So for me, this has all been the same.
Now, putting a novel out for you after your other writings as well, how much pressure do you put on yourself as a penman, if you will?
You know, for me personally, I have always written about what I want to write about. So I'm writing it because I want to get it out on paper. And it just so happens I've been very lucky in the fact that other people have liked what I've written. so for me, it doesn't really matter. The publisher, on the other hand, you know, they're very nervous and they want you to stay in your lane. You know, I've written a bunch of kids books. When I started writing kids books, they were really nervous about me writing kids books until the kids books were hugely successful. They were nervous about this one until they started getting reviews back from the big book review, and all the big book reviews started writing these incredible reviews of this book. So, I'm not nervous about it. I'm happy to get it out there. I know it's a great story and I know that people will get a lot out of it.
And Jocko, for you to have the support system that you've got, I mean, how much does that show to the way that you've treated people and the way that you've worked through your life as well?
Yeah, I mean, number one support system for me is my wife. And she, you know, we've been married for coming up on 25 years, I think. I was doing deployment after deployment after deployment overseas, and she was back at home raising three and then four kids. And just doing an incredible job. And that's allowed me to get out there and do these other things. And so my biggest support system, 100%, is my wife.
And with the book out today, do you do anything extra special before release day? Is there any special thing that you do, or are you unsuperstitious to a T?
I'm unsuperstitious. This is it's a great day. I'm happy to get it out there. And the most important thing I'm looking forward to is I'm looking forward to people reading this book, hearing these characters, getting to know these characters, and then seeing how the story unfolds. It's an emotional roller coaster. When I was doing the audio book, I had the audio engineer, just me and one other woman in there. Her name was Deb. And as I was reading the audio book, she was laughing hysterically, and then she was cheering. And then at points she was openly weeping. So I know the book has some highs and lows, and I'm looking forward to people experiencing that and learning some lessons from it.
That's awesome. And again, the new book available now, Final Spin. Jocko, always want to make sure and let folks know where they can find not only more about the book, but also your podcast, your million other things that you've got going on as well, sir.
Yeah, I'm on social media at Jocko Willink. And then you can pretty much find everything that I am related to at Jocko.com.
There you go. Well, Jocko, I really appreciate you taking some time out of your schedule, especially on release day. Looking forward to checking out the book myself and talking again real soon, brother.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Appreciate the support.
Now, the Elf on a Shelf has been a welcome tradition for a lot of families throughout the past decade or so. But apparently, the elves' movements have become an unwelcome burden for some parents. So a judge in Cobb County, Georgia, named Judge Rob Leonard, is offering local parents an out. He just made an order requesting that the elf not show up in homes this holiday season. He said that inexplicably some elves fail to move, and when that occurs, it can disappoint the children. And with everything going on, he believes it's best to banish all elves on shelves from Cobb County. Now, clearly this is tongue-in-cheek, and it's unclear how official it is. But in any event, the parents who still welcome the elf can keep it. He said the order is a, quote, gift to tired parents, but there are also, quote, no contempts, so you can ignore it.
Got a new movie coming out on the 19th called Black Friday, and it's a Black Friday like you've never seen before. We've got Bruce Campbell to discuss it with us, and Bruce, always good to visit with you, sir.
Thank you. I happened to be in the neighborhood, thought I'd stop in.
Exactly. Now, Black Friday, what did it mean to you before you got to working on this project?
Black Friday before this was the time and place to avoid. At all costs, avoid the mall, avoid any place that has a cash register on Black Friday, because I'm good. I'm good. I'm not a big mass crowd kind of guy, and aggressive crowds, I'm so not into. You know, I don't want to get crushed because of a toy.
You got to draw a line somewhere, right?
I think so too. I value my body.
Now, Bruce, tell our listeners, if they have not seen the trailers yet, about Black Friday, about the spin you guys take on the new film.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you like The Breakfast Club?
It's of classic. Course.
Yeah, well, this is The Breakfast Club with carnage and mayhem. That's all you need to know. It's I play a loser manager of a loser toy store-ish type place that on Black Friday gets invaded by aliens. And we are the least prepared people to defend the world from aliens, but we're going to give it a shot.
Now, what was your thought when you first saw the script? You first saw the role and the characters. What was your first impression?
That it had humor, and it had a pulse behind just the progression of the, you know, alien does this, eats this guy, kills this guy. I joke about it being The Breakfast Club. There's actually a weird sociological component to this movie about employees and ownership and management. And holidays and customers, there's a little editorializing in the middle of all the carnage and mayhem, which kind of makes me laugh.
Now, tell our listeners also the cast. I know Michael Jai White and some of the other cast members as well. What was it like? Was this pre-COVID or was this during pandemic that shooting took place?
Oh, no, full pandemic. You know, I don't think I've ever been busier during pandemic, because what happened is, you know, we were deemed non-essential, so we had to stand down. And then in the meantime, everybody watched every movie ever made. And they listened to every podcast and watched every TV show. And our industry looked around and we were like, we got to get busy. And so we've all leapt to work. So, yeah, this was in the middle of all this. Working in that group of thespians, they all had come from genre movies. Devin Sawa, he's got his own little following, you know. They were all really fun and they had experience. So what's kind of nice is when you come from the world of genre, you know what knee pads are, you know how to fake when the camera is shaking, and you know how to react to monsters. You know, you know all that stuff. I pity the fool actor who goes from a soap opera to a B movie. They'll be lost. How to do stunts, how to finish off a stunt, how to fight with a stunt guy. You know, those are good skills. And it was fun to work with other thespians who had the same high skills.
Now, what did you learn through shooting during the pandemic? How much different was it? And what did you take away from it moving forward?
My takeaway is that my movie people are very resilient. We are an industry, and I don't have to tell anybody who's continued to work in a location somewhere during the pandemic, you know, wearing a mask, it blows, no question about it. And on a movie set, if you're closer than a certain distance for a certain amount of time, not only a mask, but a shield. So I looked out at one point and I said to the crew, I'm like, you now know what it's like to play Darth Vader. And so it was very challenging, but I have to say the people in the entertainment business were a bunch of idiots, but we are very resilient. And, you know, you pick it up, you go, okay, what do we need? We have to test. Where do you test? Okay, over here. Well, who tests you? You sign up a company and okay, where do we do this? And apparently it's about 10% extra to the cost of a production because of the extra personnel and testing, and it slows you down a little bit, but you can manage it. So, you know, we all look forward to a set running around with our faces. You know, we're actors. We love to show you our stupid faces. So hopefully we'll get back to that.
And having the movie out in theaters, also on demand, and Bruce, what's it like the way the streaming platforms and all that stuff has helped some of the new movies as well?
Well, we're just going to all have to figure this out because we're all tap dancing as fast as we can. Theaters want to get you back, understandably. So, you know, we're going to have more of the Barca Lounger type theater experience. You can buy your ticket online and do all that sort of stuff. So everything's going to get better and easier, and movies are still going to be fun to go to. But streaming has really come into its own, because if you're at home much more than you used to be, well, let's fix that TV. Yep, let's get the surround sound. Let's start upgrading all that stuff. So streaming is completely valid now. Netflix has been put on the map because of what they do at the time that they do it. Timing is everything. And man, to have owned Netflix stock, 2 years ago, who knew?
That's right. Now, again, the movie Black Friday, available November 19th. And Bruce, I always want to make sure and let folks know where they can find more about not only the movie, but everything you've got going social media wise as well, sir.
Well, you can always start with my website. It's just bruce-campbell.com. If you don't put the hyphen in, you get a Dodge dealership in Michigan, I think, of the Bruce Campbell Dodge. I'm at Bruce World. Well, it's what am I on Twitter? I'm Groovy Bruce, and I'm Instagram. I'm Shemp Malone. I just use a pseudonym just because Instagram is nothing commercial whatsoever. It's all stupid photographs and dumb gags. And then, I use Twitter for stuff like click on this link to buy a ticket. So, and Facebook, I'm just too terrified of. It's too much of a rabbit hole that you can go down that.
The thriller actor and the zombie movie actor, and he says, Facebook, too much for me.
Too scary.
That's awesome. Well, Bruce, always good to visit with you, sir. I appreciate, again, you taking the time out of your schedule. Looking forward to checking out Black Friday, and hopefully we can catch up again real soon.
Give my regards to Oklahoma.
Do you have a Clark Griswold type neighbor who's always staple gunning thousands of Christmas lights to his roof? Well, a new poll found only a third of us plan to put up our Christmas decorations by Thanksgiving. But it's not because we aren't ready to see them yet. We might just be lazy. Almost half of Americans want their neighbors to put up their Christmas decorations by Thanksgiving. 49% said yes. Around half of those people wish their neighbors already had their decorations up. So if you've been holding off because you don't want to annoy people, don't worry too much. A lot of us are waiting for it. And the last stat is also interesting too. The most popular day of the year to put up Christmas decorations is Black Friday. 24% of people said the day after Thanksgiving is when they usually start decorating for the holidays. Another 23% said after that, but before December 1st. I'm honored and deeply appreciative of the opportunity to visit with somebody that has been in my life, whether she knew it or not, in the entirety of my life. We've got Karen Grassley with us today. And Karen, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
And if folks don't know from the name, and if they're not watching on a video, Karen played Ma Ingalls on Little House on the Prairie. And Karen, you've got the new book, Bright Lights, Prairie Dust. We're a week out from this being available. And how excited are you and how nervous are you, I guess, for it to be in the hands of the readers?
I'm so excited. I worked on this book for years and years and years. I had to peel a lot of layers to come to what the story really is. And I think this book represents it. And I am so thrilled that people want to read it, just thrilled. And so far, so many people are excited to read it. So, yeah. Yeah. I have one here. Should I show it to your audience?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Ta-da! It came, a box came while I was down in LA making the recording, and I was so excited to open it up.
What's it like to see the final product after going through, like you said, years of writing and battling with this, if you will?
It's wonderful. It's just wonderful. There it is. Yeah. So I did it.
What was it that led to the initial idea of writing the book? And how did you have to be talked into it to maybe open it up a little bit?
Nobody was coming to me saying, why don't you write a memoir? I was just living quietly, as I have done. And I moved up here to the San Francisco Bay Area. And I was semi-retired, you know, just doing the occasional play or the occasional independent movie. And I just started to have this rush of memories. So I wanted to write those down. I didn't want to miss them, you know. And then I got very interested. And I took a class and then took another class. And then a group of us formed a writing group. And in that writing group, we helped each other and we encouraged each other. And that has been tremendous, you know, because all on your own, you can think, is this anything? You know? So it took a long time for me to figure out, is this a book? And if so, what is the point? You know? And I think I did find what it is about. There are a lot of themes. But it's really my woman's story in a tough profession, having come from an alcoholic home and all the bruises and wounds that that leaves, and the work that I had to do to come to myself. And while I could play Ma, it took much more work for Karen to come to herself.
Whenever you first came into the role of Ma, I mean, that's what you are endeared. That's what people love you for the role of Ma. It wasn't always an endearing role for you, was it?
Well, the first time that I read the script, I thought, oh, like she's complaining and maybe she's kind of negative and he's so cute and plays the violin. And so I thought, I don't know about this. But, you know, as soon as we went to work on it, I began to appreciate her. The very first day we're leaving home, I'll probably never see my parents again. I've got three little girls. We're going into the wilderness with no idea of what we're going to find. And for sure, there could be hostile Native Americans. Carolyn was very frightened of that. And I began to understand her bravery and her journey. And off we went, you know.
Now, how long did it take you to feel comfortable in the role initially?
Gosh, I don't know. I don't really know, you know. I was learning everything so quickly, how to work on film, these different techniques that you need to know. I was learning my lines at night and falling asleep with the script in my hand, and the hours were long. So for me, I don't know about comfort. I mean, I was just making it each day, you know, get that work, get it in, get it done. And it was very encouraging when Mike liked my work and gave me positive feedback. So I guess it might have taken a whole season.
What did you learn most about yourself through the portrayal of Ma as well?
Did you read the book?
I have not yet.
Because that question is so fitting. Well, you know, I was an actress. I had been divorced. I didn't have a stable relationship. I didn't have financial security. And I thought those were things that were important before you have a child. So I had put it out of my mind that I can't have a child now and I'll worry about that later. But as I was working on Little House and the years were rolling by and Ma had early menopause, I was like, you know, my time could be passing here. Mm. And in the meantime, I was constantly reminded of mothering, constantly. So it came to me very deeply that I really, really wanted to be a mother. And I took this realization to an older, wiser friend. I had been up crying and crying in the night and waited until dawn, you know, to call her. And she said, come on over. And she fixed me a meatloaf sandwich. She said, well, now what's going on? And I told her, you know, I want to be a mother. And she said, well, great. Now we know what you want. Let's see what God wants. You know, because sometimes it's our will and it doesn't turn out to be the will of the powers that be. So it's meant a lot to me that I got to have a son. And in fact, he was here for dinner last night. And I have to tell you, he cooked the dinner. I was so tired yesterday. And he made a really nice dinner for me. And I felt, wow, I'm so lucky.
During the process of the filming, what was maybe one of the hardest parts on you? I mean, being a stage actor, actress, as opposed to the screen, I mean, how much different? I mean, as a layperson, never been on a screen whatsoever, we always think that they're one and the same, but they're not even close, I'm sure.
Well, they're the same in that you have to find the truth inside of you. But how that truth comes out of you has to be different. Because if you're in a big theater, you've got to reach the back wall and you've got to convey through your body the emotion that you're having. But for me to be acting in this little frame like we're in right now was the hardest thing. Feeling like I was in such a box. I was in this tiny box. And that everything had to happen within that. That was the biggest adjustment because I loved the big physical stuff, you know, like later in the award when I got to fight with the cow in the rain, you know, big, big physical stuff. That was fun for me. And then I was in a little box and I was all, my elbows were pinned to my sides and that was hard.
Now, what was maybe one of the biggest takeaways from your time working with Michael? We know he was pretty difficult to work with at times, a perfectionist, we've heard, wants things his way. How did you have to learn about working together with others, even in sometimes tense environments?
Well, he was a very, very complicated person, but a very, very gifted person. And he was definitely our leader, not only producing, starring, but also directing and writing a lot of the episodes. So there was no question about whose vision we were portraying. Mm-hmm. That was going to be Mike's. You know, there was no argument about that. However, there were times when he was very open to hearing my take on what Ma might do in a scene. Like there was a scene where Pa is away working. I think it was the one where he goes off and is doing the dynamite stuff. Mm-hmm. Very dangerous. And I think they had written that Ma is sitting by the fire worrying. And I was like, I don't think so. You know. So I talked to Mike. I said, you know, if this were my mother, she would be up. She would be scouring that house. Everything would be clean. Every closet, every bit of work would get her anxiety. And he said, that's great. So we did something like that.
During the process of the show, what were the hard times? Was it the times between filming that was difficult emotionally for you?
The hard time for me was when they told me that after the first season, you renegotiate your contract based on the fact that it's a success. If it's a success, you'll renegotiate. It's taken for granted in Hollywood. So when my representative and I went to see Mike to talk about that, he didn't want to talk about it. And then a long, drawn out, painful process where he did not back me one bit. In fact, he tried to talk me out of even that I deserved it. And that hurt. But I'll tell you something. Being on a TV series was not my dream. I was very glad to have the job. I knew it was a really good job, but it was not my dream come true. So if I was going to do it, I wanted to be paid fairly for it. And to this day, Cameron, I do not understand why this man was so opposed to paying a fair salary to his co-star. I don't get it, but that's the way it was. So that was a long, drawn out thing, you know, where I waited for phone calls and the network would go quiet, and it was really unpleasant. And then I would go to work and I wouldn't know what I was making or if we were going to settle it or what was going to happen. It was very unnerving. So that was the hardest thing, the hardest.
And then going on set in the midst of all of that, I mean, how amazed are you looking back that you made it through and the viewers were none the better for it, if you will?
Well, I'm very proud of the fact that it didn't show in my work. People would never know that there was this icy atmosphere. You know, I'm really, really proud of that. But for me, as an alcoholic, you can imagine the self-pity and the anger and resentment. So, boy, I drank a lot over that. And that helped me hit my bottom. No question about it.
And what was it that whenever you reached the bottom, what was it that was the light that made you realize, because we talked before we came on, we've both been through these moments, but what was the light for you?
A series of things happened, one on top of the other. One, we were shooting a show and I wanted to make a spread for the crew, a kind of a wrap party for the episode. And one of the things that I had at that lunch was some wine and soft drinks. And after we were supposed to go back to work, I was still thinking about that wine bottle. I was like, shake it off. Now, and I went outdoors. I breathed some air. I went to the bathroom. I took some mouthwash. I did everything I could, and my mind was still over there in that wine bottle. Oh, Jesus. Well, then I had this trip immediately afterwards, so I didn't think about it. And on the trip, I was to give a talk in front of a large group of women that I respected. And they were a little late coming. So, you know, I had to have a little wine before. And then a little more because they were still not there. And then a little more so that when I gave my talk, I went on and on and on. And then I realized it and I was so embarrassed. I thought, I just can't bear it that I did this. And I sat down in my seat, my face, I felt like it was red hot. I was really embarrassed. So then, of course, I got on a plane and drank some more and went to see my dearest, oldest friend in the world. She and I had known each other since we were 7 years old.
Wow.
And we had had plenty of drinks together too. And grass. So she met me at the airport, took me out to her little cabin in Minneapolis, and told me I had a drinking problem. Well, I knew she knew. She knew me. I couldn't argue with her. But I told her, I can't go to those self-help programs. I can't do that. So we kind of left it there. But she had made an important impression on me. And I guess it was about 1 week later that I had to do it one more time and come home crying and fight with a friend and all of that, pass out in my bed. And when I woke up in the morning with another horrible hangover, I said, I must never drink again, no matter what happens. And I thought that if I made a decision like that, that it would mean I couldn't go to a nice restaurant. It would even mean I couldn't have Mexican food because I wouldn't be able to drink a beer with it.
Right.
I mean, I had these ideas about how alcohol was laced into my life. But I said, whatever. If my boyfriend leaves me, whatever. If I lose my job, whatever. I can't drink. And like you, that was it. It was a miracle. Many times I had tried to quit for a week or so, and I never made it.
Yeah, that's amazing. What was the driving force keeping you sober? Was it not wanting to go down those roads again? What was your sober story?
Well, God kept me from going down those roads again. But I was scared to death to drink again. You know, I had always tried to argue with the rules, make an exception of myself. I was full of opinions about everything. And now I just wanted to walk the straight and narrow. I was humbled. I was like, I don't have the best ideas. Let me see what other people can teach me about this. I was even afraid to park illegally. I was afraid, what if I park illegally, maybe I'll drink. You know, I was scared to drink again. So I would say fear was a big part of it.
What doors did the sobriety open for you personally?
Well, it's a different kind of honesty. You know, I always had this kind of honesty where, oh, I paid my bills and my taxes and all that. And I love to be honest about you and tell you about what you were thinking or doing. But taking full responsibility for me, that took some insight. And it took being sober to get the insight. You know, I did a lot of writing, a lot of writing about my life, about my feelings, a lot of praying. I had a lot to learn. And that's part of what this book is the journey of someone who had a lot to learn and wanted to learn it. You know, because it's not all about sobriety. I mean, I was wanting to learn about life from the time I was little. And by the time I was a young actress in New York, I was reaching out for Jungian analysis. I was reaching out to find out, you know, how you live. How do you make sense of it all? And I suffered from depression. So I had a lot of work to do around that. Yeah. Well, it's been busy, you know.
Yeah, I know, right? Now, how were you able to hide the depression from others? Or were you maybe hiding that more from yourself?
I wish that I could have hidden it a little better than I did. I think sometimes I was rather morose. blue, you know, she's got the blues, mm-hmm. sort of heavy. I didn't mean to be a drag, but I could be. And, you know, the other thing is, you know, I got this smile. That smile hides a lot of stuff if you want it to.
The book, like we said, is going to be available next Tuesday, Bright Lights, Prairie Dust. And what is your overall thought of the completed project? And are you going to sleep any between now and next Tuesday? Are you just so excited?
I'm very, very excited. And I'm going to talk to a lot of people about the book because I want people to read it. I think that it has value. Even if I say that about something that I wrote, a lot of work has gone into it. I've had a lot of people help me with notes, and I've done a lot of revising to make it the best I could be at this time in my life. And I think it's worthwhile. I think there are lessons in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are lessons about taking responsibility for yourself and being honest with yourself. And about faith, and about going for your dream, and about making the effort even when things are very, very hard.
That's one that I still battle with, is when you go through the frustrations and, you know, you have your ups and your downs, and you're like, am I really wasting my time today? But keep battling every day.
Well, you know, it's always so hard to know, you know, am I supposed to battle or am I supposed to give up? But we just have to keep on until we know.
That's right. Well, Karen, it has been a huge honor for me to have the chance to visit with you today. I always save and read the books after the interview because I don't want to spoil anything before we visit. So I'm looking forward to spending time with the book, and hopefully we can catch up again, maybe on a future project or just to catch back up again.
That would be great. And thank you so much for having me and letting me talk with your audience.
Well, thanks again for joining us for this 148th episode in season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. If you ever have a comment, question, maybe anything else you'd like to know, you can hit me up on the contact page at gqwithcam.com. You can also find me on the socials, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Facebook, all at GQ with Cam. If you'd like to help out in the funding for this podcast, you can visit our merch store where we've got hoodies, shirts, tumblers, mugs, stickers, and more. That's gqwithcam.com/shop. And if you have a special guest idea, email me, gqwithcam@gmail.com. Well, again, thanks to our good friend Brandon Allen for coming up with our theme music. We're going to let him play us out and hope you guys have a great rest of your evening.